Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau. And I didn't order Night Witches, so.
But somebody did.
Latest Kickstarter I backed was Night Witches by Bully Pulpit Games, the same guys who did Fiasco and a couple other games. So it's what? World War II era Soviet air women, which, yeah, I thought it was interesting. So hopefully it will prove to be interesting when it shows up.
It looks interesting. Like, I can't actually say that I'm all that drawn in by the idea of the setting, but the mechanics look interesting in that they have a different set of mechanics and moves for the day and for the night, one being more kind of drama and character-centric and the other one being more action-adventure-y.
Well, that really seems to fit because from what little I read of the actual historical group, that is the only time they conducted raids was at night.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... There is a reason why it's balanced like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a cool idea, but it's hard to think of a rationalization to fit it into a game. So, it's cool.
Yeah, no, they're Night Witches. Why would they have day mechanics?
Right.
Apparently the Germans named them. And because they would cut their engine and glide down or something.
Mm.
So the only sound would be the sound of the air rushing by.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounded like... Witches on broomsticks, so they call them night witches.
Yeah.
According to the little blurb on the Kickstarter, when they ran out of bombs to drop, they dropped railroad ties.
I didn't see that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's awesome in the one sense where, yeah, that's pretty badass, but it's not so awesome in the sense where, yeah, they were that underfunded and lacked all that equipment.
Well, the Russian army at that time was pretty much one of the defining characteristics.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
No, like, I'm definitely excited to look at it from kind of a game design perspective, but... of course I'd be happy to give it a run. Never against trying a new game.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's unusual in the sense that it's focusing on a very, very specific unit. So, like, you might have, okay, a World War II game. All right, well, we'll narrow that down. We got a Russian World War II game. Okay, let's narrow it down. It's like Air Force. Let's narrow it down even further. And it's this
only
one unit. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, like, it sounds like it'd be a cool premise for a campaign, but it's kind of the whole system, it can be built for one campaign, you know? Would you really, after you played it for maybe 6 months or so, would you want to pick it up again and do the same thing again?
But that seems to be the Savage Worlds, Fate, and Apocalypse World kind of thing, where people do, like, little spin-offs, like a very narrow game.
Mm,
like, some
people
do really, really broad... Like the spirit of 77.
True.
Where they draw upon so many different genres and mash them all together. But a lot of times that they seem to go, okay, very, very specific one. I mean, there's a Fate thing that we're looking at where it's called Base Raiders. And
oh, right.
It's interesting premise where the superheroes and the supervillains disappear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the characters play people who raid their bases.
Hence the name, right.
Hmm. Yeah, which is really interesting, but yeah, wow, that's really narrow. It's not like you're playing superheroes or supervillains, you're playing other people, and what do? You're actually just raiding these bases, you're not investigating their disappearance. Well, maybe you are when you read the book or something.
Right.
But.
No, I had seen that before, and yeah, we got it because we just bought the recent bundle of Holding, which happened to be a bunch of Fate games,
mm-hmm.
Which Base Raiders is included, and I had seen that before, and to me it seemed like a modern update of the dungeon crawl.
Yeah, that's like, what I was thinking of.
Okay,
too,
I mean, you're crawling through essentially a dungeon, which is mm-hmm. actually either a superhero or supervillain lair, but because they've all disappeared, you know, you're just kind of like normal-ish characters, so that the technology in these bases can kind of approximate the, you know, arcane mysteries of fantasy-esque dungeon crawl.
Right.
Yeah, I was imagining like Doctor Doom and that, but still it seemed... These type of games are really geared towards people developing niche games such as Night Witches, and it's like, okay, let's really focus and hyper-specialize on this one thing, and we'll try out this one mechanic.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, like, the kind of thing I was thinking of is I could imagine really easily doing a campaign based on something like a unit in the U.S., for example, the Tuskegee Airmen. And I think that would be a really fun campaign to do, but it's hard to imagine it being more than a single event, a single campaign.
Except for the syphilis, maybe.
Well, yeah, you know, that part would be so far. But, yeah.
No, I see what you're saying, but, I mean, that's true on the one hand, but, like, I guess on the other hand, with the price of entertainment, if you do get that 6 months or 4 months or however much out of it, like, is that still money well spent for what you got?
You got a really good point. Yeah. It really is, yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's one way to look at it. Plus,
you spend, $15 for a movie?
Right,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and that's 3 hours now. 3.5 if you stay for those lousy Marvel end credit things.
6 days if it's Lord of the Rings.
Right. It does seem that many games are kind of hyper specializing, but yeah.
But you know, when you say 6 months of gaming, it's not like they're playing it for 6 months. So
6 months,
however
straight,
many
yeah.
hours.
Yeah, for us, right.
Fall,
it's three
fall
sessions.
Within that.
Right.
So from one group of warriors to another. In today's installment of our Warrior series, we're going to look at the Persian Immortals. And for those not familiar with our Warrior series, this is where we take a real-world group of warriors and we pull out elements that, if not unique, are pretty special to that group and look at how we can use those elements to enrich a game or to enrich a character. And not necessarily a warrior character.
Right. Hopefully we're pulling out stuff that can apply to any character we play.
Yeah. And you know, another one thing that should be said, because sometimes we pull out like modern day warriors, sometimes we pull out, you know, ancient warriors, but it doesn't mean that you're locked into those genres. So like Persian Immortals doesn't mean that you can only play either real world, ancient, or fantasy kind of games. You could play like a modern or a science fiction game.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And another thing that we like to do with our warrior series is we like to give the elements in the tongue of the warriors, and this proved to be quite a challenge.
Right.
Well, it does every time, really, but...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but maybe we forget every time, yeah. But this was especially difficult because we were looking at English to Persian or English to Farsi. I think there's a little bit of a difference between those two languages now that we've mastered them. But it's quite frustrating because if you type in a word in English, things like Google Translate will give you the Persian, but written in the Persian script.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And without any Roman characters to tell you how to say it.
Right. There also didn't seem to be a button to listen to how it was said in Persian, which is what I was looking for.
They had the button for English, though.
Yeah, they did. So if I want to know how to say these things in English, I got that down. But, yeah, Persian or Farsi, not so much.
So we found one site. So hopefully the translations prove accurate. So apologies to any listeners in Iran.
We will butcher this no worse than we did the French for Musketeers.
Oui. But yeah, send us an email and let us know just how badly screwed it up.
All right. So what's our first element for the Persian Immortals, Wayne?
Our first element is Anousa, which translates as immortals.
Who'd have thunk?
Yeah, who'd have thunk?
Yeah. And we should say not all of our elements come from the actual name.
Right.
I think this is one of the first or the only one that's come from the actual name. Like our musketeers say, hey, and the first element is musketeer.
Right. No, this is the first one that does pretty much just translate the name of the warrior type that we're talking about. But
and the fun trivia is nobody knows if it's the actual translation or not.
Right. Because it could have been a mistranslation that didn't actually mean immortal, but just meant companion.
Which is much less badass.
Very true. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. Who's that over there? That's my companion.
But I doubt they're rolling in their graves going, oh, no, we're companions. They're like, immortals. Yeah, no, that's cool.
All right. Yeah.
I'm done with that.
But anyway, I think part of the reason they were called immortals is that the number of troops in the unit was always set at 10,000. Reports say that pretty much immediately when an immortal died, either in combat or retired or, you know, got sick and died because, hey, it was the ancient world, they had someone ready to take his place. And for whatever reason, the unit was always fixed at 10,000 men.
And I got to admit, that's just one of the things that I don't get. I don't understand it.
Why they put a cap?
why they would put a cap, why they would fix it. I mean, yes, it is pretty badass, but at the same time, you know, it means that there's some operations which they wouldn't be able to do because there's not enough of them. There's some where it would be overkill, and it's...
I'm trying to wonder what operation would they would not be able to do with 10,000 of them.
Oh, well, okay, they're facing off against 30,000 Greeks.
Okay, as soon as I said that, I'm like, the Battle of the Hotcakes.
Right? But I mean, like, of course, they didn't always show up with all 10,000 of them in the same place at the same time, of course. So, I mean, that's not a big deal. But it's just kind of those, why impose upon yourself such inflexibility? Is just, I don't really understand it.
Well, it could be because they were, in addition to, like, a royal guard, they were a standing army.
Mm-hmm.
And standing armies are really, really expensive.
True.
It's only really in modern times that we have the idea of like a standing army and soldiers. Mm.
But then go into it as well with that. If they have the always have 10,000 and they're immediately replaced right afterwards, then that means that in addition to that 10,000 standing army, they're going to have, I don't know how many, about 1,000 or so of what, sub-immortals? Kind of guys just waiting in the wings to be, you know, promoted?
Quasi-immortals, yeah.
Which you could probably pay much less.
Good point.
We're not 100% certain of, you know, how quickly they would say immediately somebody would step in. You know, that's a pretty relative term.
Yeah, very true.
But yeah, they did have a system, of course, a training system that started at age 5. But we found out that training system isn't so special because Persians from the ages of 5 to 12.
Right.
Were trained in, like, the art of the bow and horseback riding and that. And it was just expected.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess Persian males.
Mm-hmm.
So we should say we're not 100% from sure how they would slot into the 10,000 or how quickly this immediately really was.
Right.
But one source says that the immortals served from about the age of 15 to the age of 50.
Mm-hmm.
So... maybe between 15 to 20 or 15 to 25, and this is just pure speculation, that's them being in a reserve of waiting to slot into something.
Mm-hmm.
And and they also said if somebody fell sick, somebody would take their place. Somebody could fall sick and then recover.
Right.
So I wonder if people slotted out or...
then they kill them.
maybe. I mean, the impression I got from reading that if someone... you know, took their place because that person got sick, it meant that person died from sickness as opposed to dying in battle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you read, like, World War II history and they talk about divisions, and divisions had not necessarily fixed at, like, you know, 10,000, but they have, like, the ideal strength. But then, you know, as the story progresses and the history unfolds, and they would talk about the divisions, but then they would also have to clarify, but they were at half strength or they only had these many tanks operational and that. So it's quite conceivable that the Persian, that they want to keep the reputation of a full 10,000 always being there.
Right.
But maybe the reality is like 8,000 were operational and 2,000 were being trained or sick or whatever.
Right.
Very likely, yeah.
Right, that's a good point. Because, like, I totally agree with Chris where it seems kind of odd to, you know, put a maximum cap on the number of immortals. But as you said, Lyle... they were also the standing army, which means you have to pay them. And I read that in times of peace, the immortals were also the royal guard.
Mm-hmm.
So, you put a cap on them just because it'll get too expensive if you have too many of them. But also, just saying that there are always 10,000 of these guys, I mean, even if it's not true, as we said before, that's pretty awesome. And... you know, if you're going up against these guys, then the fact that there are always 10,000 of them, or the fact that they, you know, replace their numbers as soon as someone falls, I think that was probably a big deal back in ancient times when you didn't have a standing army. I mean, it could take years to gather enough people together to actually have that number of soldiers at one place.
That's actually a really good point, Wink, to think about. If you fought a battle against the immortals and you say, well, we killed 300 of them today, so how many are there? Still 10,000.
Yeah, there's still 10,000 of them, yeah.
Yeah, with the reputation, yeah, that could cause the opponent to waver if they think that, well, they have the replacements ready.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people theorize the reason why the Romans were able to conquer their part of the world so quickly before they became the empire is just because they had this pool of manpower that no other group could match.
Mm-hmm.
So they could wipe out a Roman army, and then they would be able to throw in another army to take their place.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just wear down their enemies. So we have the idea of, oh, no, I mean, they're superior, but it was oftentimes they just wore them down.
Mm-hmm.
But even when you look at the British Army, the Redcoats, and they had the idea of the thin red line, and some, you would shoot them, and a guy would just step into the line to take his place.
Mm, true, true.
And it just kept the firepower going. But also, I imagine, yeah, psychologically, you're like, it doesn't matter how many of them we shoot.
Right.
You know, the line doesn't waver.
Right. No. Yeah, I like that.
And that could actually bolster the... And we're talking about if you're going to play people in a similar type of unit or in a group that has that similar concept, is that can be psychologically empowering from them because you're always going to have the person to your left and right to support you. Maybe not literally, like they're going to be right next to you, but you know that the numbers are always going to be there and going to be on your side.
Right. When we do Warriors episodes, we pretty much always talk about playing as that warrior type. And so, yeah, like you said, Lyle, knowing that as soon as somebody falls, there's going to be someone to take their place. Yeah, that I'm sure that gave the Immortals themselves a pretty big morale boost.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, even if you were not Immortals, but still in the Persian army, I imagine that knowing that those guys are always going to be at 10,000, that would be a huge morale boost as well. And, yeah, I'm not saying play what would be regulars in the Persian army, because we're talking about the Immortals, but that is something to consider as well.
Or it's even like facing a group like the Immortals, and you look at a movie like The Matrix, and they have the agents, and just an eye, maybe it's 10, like a small number, but it doesn't matter how many you kill, there's always going to be that number.
Yeah, right? True.
The next time, it'll be another 10, and that will be, I mean, it's going to wear you down physically, psychologically, mentally, so... Mm. Like playing with that idea that there's always going to be someone else to replace whatever you defeat. And that can be very frustrating for the players. But if you really play that up.
I mean, usually we see that in like, I don't know, I'm going to say evil horde armies, you know, like aliens or, you know, some kind of weird bug thing, you know. Or again, like Tyranids from Warhammer 40,000. They just keep coming and there's a swarm of them. But this is, I don't know, this to me feels different because there is that foresight and that training of, you know, if they did have to go through what, like 15, 20 years of training before you could become an immortal, then it says a lot about the empire that they come from, where it's like, we have enough people to put these guys into training so that 20 years from now, they'll be able to step in to fill somebody's spot.
Oh yeah. I mean, it gives the Horde a personality,
mm-hmm.
But it also allows for, I mean, you can't really play a Horde.
Right.
You say, "Oh, good. I'm one yeah. of the nameless.
I'm a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, right. a drop in the bucket. I'm a mindless zombie. I'm a Zerg. Is that what you say?
Yeah, Zerg.
Yeah, Zerg.
Oh boy, Zergling. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you have the idea, you could be like start as a reserve, and you want to get into the main Immortals or whatever you're going to call it in your game.
Immortals. Yeah.
Oh, sure, because it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, like, you know, numbers go down, and that gives you the opportunity. A lot of times, you know, you talk about, oh, there's an apprentice system, and we do the apprentice system. Once I complete that, I'm in. But here, it's not even like you complete that, you're in. You got to wait for somebody to drop and in a sense, fill their shoes.
Mm. Yeah, that's got to be kind of scary, because filling the shoes, I mean, like, yeah, I'm sure they were, the Immortals were seen as great by, you know, the people under them, and so it's like, oh, it's on the one hand, you're probably like, I was waiting for this, you know, my whole life, and now I got to step up and fill that role that's been filled by who knows how many people before me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a big weight on your shoulders. Huh.
Be a fun thing if they, I know it's not true, but if they pass down their name or something. To
that
would like, be cool too.
I mean, like Kabuki or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking, no, I think that's a great idea. Like they take on the identity, yeah, mm-hmm. like you suggested. But, you know, when you look at a war movie, when the fresh meat gets off the plane or gets off the boat, and the veterans treat that person poorly, you could do that, sure, because it's like a more traditional military campaign. But what if the Immortals were different? Is that you're an immortal now?
Mm.
There are no veterans. There are no rookies. Everybody's the same.
Hmm.
So you walk in and you have the same status as everybody else, in a sense. I mean, the right. Immortals actually did have a more elite 1,000 within the 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
But at least within that unit, it's like, no, you've stepped in. You're now an immortal. You're one of the 10,000.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Pretty sweet.
No. Yeah, I like that idea.
This is kind of out there, but what would you think about playing that, is if we're talking about passing down the identity of a person when the person dies, playing that identity? So even if the character dies, a new character would come to fill into it. So your character's personality would change as a new person is filling the role, but you're still playing someone with the same name. Interesting way to play a horde, kind of like your character actually changes out despite not changing.
No, I mean, you could do that even for a small party. No, that's a good idea. Like if you had a party of 6 people,
mm-hmm.
and you know one of them dies, then it makes it quite easy to insert another character into it. It's because you're stepping into that person's place.
That's mm-hmm. exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. If we use D&D for example, the person who died was a cleric. You could step in as a wizard. It doesn't matter because you're just stepping into the role of the 6, and mm-hmm. they're all there to do whatever.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't think that far ahead. I just thought about, you know, normal in many games, it's kind of a challenge to work in a new character after someone dies, especially if it's like an ongoing game.
Yep.
Whereas playing the Immortals, nope, it gives you a perfect reason about why that person is there, because somebody died and someone immediately steps in to take their place.
Oh, yeah, and you can do that in, like, I mean, it could be you're a special group of vampires in Requiem. It could be a superhero group that has all these reservists that, and they step in, and I'm part of the Avengers.
Right. Go away.
Although, actually, maybe the comic books is a bad example because it never seems to be really difficult for them to just scrap a team and insert new people.
Well, also, the thing I was thinking of, when do comic book superheroes ever really die? With, you know,
at least permanently. That way.
Yeah, exactly, permanently. Great. Oh, Superman's back, so right. I'm not Superman.
Which would kind of suck for the new guy. It's like, all right, I'm back.
All right, Steel, you're out. Okay. You truly are immortal, Superman. I know. Yeah. We all are. And Batman, you died too, right? Yeah. And I'm out of here. But you're a regular guy. Nah, well, you know. Regular, so to speak.
Yeah. Right.
You could, going back a little bit, talking about how the constant number is a big psychological factor against the immortals, you could play that in reverse against the players. If the players are playing immortals and suddenly they're going against a force that is so strong that they're unable to replenish the numbers, that'd be quite a psychological blow in reverse.
It on the one hand, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, here's something that they can't replenish from. But on the other hand, it kind of takes away a big part of what they were.
That's the idea.
That would be an interesting story. It'd be really hard to play. I mean, I could certainly see reading this as a book and following the survivors as they try to deal with it. I wonder how that would play in that it would strip away who they are, and then they're just like, okay, I guess we're just kind of like...
regular dudes now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now we're just a party,
mortals.
You know, superhero group, you know, that's no longer 10,000. Wow, a 10,000 strong superhero group. Just like, what couldn't they deal with?
Isn't that like the Green Lantern Corps or something?
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. But it's very rare for them to organize together, and then they get taken out by one quasi Superman guy. Yeah. Yeah, but there's that. Like the Green Lanterns. Every sector's got to be filled. They have all these sectors, and then as soon as one of them falls, the ring goes and finds a replacement.
Oh yeah, you know, I was just thinking of the numbers, but
Green Lanterns are immortals.
But when they do fall below strength, the comic books do try to make a little bit of that.
Hmm.
So, you know, what do? They rebuild the core. So, I mean, we'd had a similar game with 13th Age where then, I mean, we didn't really play it out too much, but...
That was more like a whittling down rather than a building up.
Yeah, and the building up actually just was kind of an epilogue where...
Oh, right.
Where the reputation of the group, and it wasn't like, well, we got to fill up this specific number, but we got to like join this mercenary group because they were so good,
right?
Yeah, but no, but actually, Chris, maybe it is playable if you focus on the small number. But if you take your idea, Chris, and you apply, you know, you have like a wizard's council, and it's like, let's say 8 members on the council, 5 members on the council,
mm-hmm.
and then you know you lose a member or 2 members after an explosive battle, then, yeah, that could make a rich story trying to find the replacements because it's always got to be that number.
Yeah.
It's a special number.
Oh, yeah, definitely. If it's a small number, yeah, I could see that. Because, okay, you know, we lose two or three guys from this council. Well, let's find, you know, those replacement two or three guys. But it's like, great, we lost, you know, 2,000 guys from this 10,000 strong unit. Oh, man, it's going to be a long game replacing all these people. So,
I mean, that's kind of the things that you have to do when you're dealing with a gaming group, because you're not going to have 10,000 players, obviously.
Right. So. Yeah, so scale it down. I mean, 10,000 is the immortal number.
The immortal number.
I was thinking 10.
So that brings us to our next element, which is what, Chris?
Istina.
We think.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah, which theoretically translates to special.
Oh, we wanted to do separate but not equal, but that proved too difficult for us to translate.
So yeah, the idea behind this is that the immortals, they had kind of their own army to themselves, and not just in the matter of fighting troops, but also all of the supply lines and support as well. They traveled with their own caravans, they had their own specialty food, they even brought along their own concubines with them when they went in campaign.
First reading it, I thought that the entire Persian army kind of traveled with lots of caravans and you know, covered wagons and all this stuff. But then, yeah, I think you're right, Chris, on, you know, doing more research, it seemed like that only the immortals were given this special treatment. Yeah, with their covered caravans and, you know, servants and, yeah, concubines and, yeah, their special food that was reserved only for them. So they were essentially like an army, a separate army within the main Persian army.
Mm-hmm. I thought the mention of special food was especially interesting.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's not as if they had their own supplies. Like, this is their supply of grain versus an identical type of grain, but they're just slightly separate. I imagine that this food was, it's almost as if they're like an elite athletic team, and they have their own diet, they have their own trainers, and that whole support system within just the regular population.
I guess it's kind of like that rich kid on the team who's the quarterback, and his parents hire the special coach for him, but, you know, he does all the kind of, you know, special training, and the rest of the team just kind of has regular trainers, in a sense.
Everybody hates him.
But there's 10,000 of these rich kids.
Right, exactly.
And one rich kid drops, another one takes his place.
Right, they're not throwing
footballs. This 1% will never waver. It'll always be 1%.
Right.
Hey, there you go. The 1% will always, like, stay at 1%. So as the population grows, they allow more people into the 1%.
Well, because it's always going to be 1% of the population.
Yeah, but it could shrink to below 1%.
Right. So we've got 100 people.
Grows. Yeah, yeah. And, you know. Come on, it's called math, Chris.
Sorry, I'm just thinking 1% of 100 people and 1% of 1,000 people. The number of people are different, but it's always still 1%.
Well, yeah, that's Lyle's point.
No, it's not the point. It's like you have a 1% of the 10,000.
I don't get how 1% can drop below 1%.
I think the point was
I was shifting, yeah. You haven't let go of... You're thinking it's 1% of the immortals, and I was talking about using the immortal concept and applying it to the 1%.
So instead of a set number, it's a set percent of the population.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on. All right, anyway.
Now I understand.
Jokes are a lot less funny when you have to explain them.
Sorry, that gear finally clicked over.
In a lot of senses, I mean, you have the special food, the servants, the concubines, but also the bling, and believe it or not, we couldn't find a translation for bling.
In ancient Farsi.
Yeah, I was disappointed too, yeah.
We actually could figure out an English translation of bling.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, thinking about it now, we probably just could have said gold, because at least the records I found, or the information I found, a lot of it seemed to be based on reports from, you know, Greek historians who were either there or getting secondhand information.
And remember is that Greek historians are often Greek poets or Greek storytellers as well.
Or just Greek exaggerators, apparently.
Exactly.
But one of the things that they said about the immortals is, yeah, the bling, the fact that they were decked out, I think one thing said in hoop earrings, or they had golden bracelets or golden chains about them to display their wealth, which, you know, talking before, if they were also the standing army, well, yeah, then they were getting paid. So perhaps that was a way of, I mean, speculation here, but perhaps that was a way of both, you know, carrying around and displaying their wealth. Like, we are good enough to have all this stuff, and we're going to prove it, or we're at least going to show it off by wearing it. Or, you know, maybe it's like the thing now of you look like you are wealthy by dressing the part.
Yeah, yeah, but also like the portable wealth, like the pirates.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Yeah,
and I think there was some. I read something about there being relief paintings to corroborate that they often did have jewelry, but it's unlikely that they actually wore it into battle because, you know, hoop earrings on a battlefield is just asking for trouble.
Right.
But one thing to note is that their spears, one of their primary weapons was this very, very long spear, and the pommel of it, as a counterweight to the very large spear point on the other end, was this weight, a circular weight, kind of looked like an apple. And those were constructed of silver for most of the immortals, or gold for the elite immortals, to the point where I think Alexander the Great's men called them apple bearers because they looked like little apples on the bottom of their spears.
I mean, couldn't they call them like apple bearers of death or something? Maybe
they think, you know, immortals are going to freak our people out too much. Let's call them apple bearers.
Right, right. Oh, watch out, here come the apple bearers. Whatever. Yeah.
They also dress pretty colorfully, unlike what you see in the movie The 300.
They're also not orcs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they didn't carry katanas. People are like, when are you going to get to the katanas? We're not.
Yeah, yeah, right. We're not.
We're never going to get to that part.
Right.
But apparently it was an earlier movie that introduced the idea that they wore all black. So a movie in the 60s about the Spartans.
Well, again, like you said, Lyle, we obviously looked at the same thing that said they were dressed very colorfully. And as Chris mentioned, kind of the thousand elite Persians. I believe they were called the purple immortals, because it kind of makes sense back then. Purple was the most expensive color of dye, you know, which is why, you know, kings wear it and stuff. But then they said there were also like blue, red, and yellow immortals, kind of broken into groups of thousand. And okay, they're really colorful. That sounds really cool. It's a interesting way to organize them, but for whatever reason, it doesn't seem that menacing. So I can see why modern times they're depicted in black, because black tends to be a scarier color, I would think.
Well, I mean, maybe now, but...
Oh, yeah, definitely
like
now,
you said,
yeah.
Purple is really expensive. I mean, it came from, like, a sea snail.
Yeah.
Which I imagine is... I don't know. Are they hard to catch? I don't know. We'll say.
I think it was the fact you just needed so many of them to...
Yeah, you gotta catch them. So, just that wealth coming at you. Like 1,000 purple soldiers. All right, it doesn't sound badass. But
it doesn't. In modern times, it doesn't sound badass.
Dressed in head to toe in yellow.
Of course, Minnesota Vikings fans are going, what are you talking about?
Right. No, but you're right. Knowing how expensive purple was back then, as you said, like, wow, what kind of ruler can afford to have 1,000 of these, you know, warriors decked out in gold jewelry and purple robes? That would probably say a lot about who you were facing, even though it seems kind of, I don't know, less than impressive or not very scary to us.
And it also helps, the colors also help differentiate the troops between each other, so they can keep track. I think Chris stumbled upon something that said they didn't like to fight at night, which we didn't think was terribly unique. But, I mean, if they do have colors and somehow that played a role in their tactics, then being able to actually see the different colors would help. I mean, they'd be able to see everybody. Oh, there's the yellow guys.
Right.
And, I don't know who's in my unit.
Oh, maybe those other yellow guys over there? Yeah.
Oh, the yellow guys are going down.
Screw you, yellow. Well, again, this is pure speculation.
Aero magnets.
Aero magnets. Yeah, gee, I'm glad we're wearing this sand camouflage. No, but, yeah, again, I think we talked a little bit about this before, and Chris, you brought up the question of, you know, how did the rulers see their troops? Because, you know, we talk about things like, the Golden Horde and the Mongol army, they use signs to communicate. Mm-hmm. And I believe you saw something that said, the commander would stand on a raised platform. Or a raised point so that he could see what was going on. Mm-hmm. And in that case, then I see the colors making perfect sense. I mean,
yeah. And, you know, it would look really nice in a parade, too. If your troops were lined up in front of the king, it would look nice if they all were different colors.
Okay, much. Going way down the badass meter.
Absolutely. But, I mean, I'm just trying to think of, some king standing up on a balcony, like, viewing over his troops, and here are these guys in these, like, colored formations of thousands. I think it would look very not intimidating, it would look impressive.
Yes, look at this vast, colorful rainbow army I have assembled.
Well, if you parade it, I'm sure it would be pretty intimidating. Hmm. I mean, if you parade a bunch of guys in camo, that's not so intimidating, even though it's effective for hiding them, but it looks kind of drab. But even modern armies will have, if they have their dress uniforms, they might have like red jackets and that, or even white jackets.
That's true.
Because that stands out. Look at the Navy when their dress uniforms are white. They have white shoes.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very good point. And I think I read that there are like surviving bricks that are still painted in colors, and they depict the immortals or other Persian warriors in very colorful garb. Though the speculation is that was ceremonial robes that they probably wouldn't have worn on the battlefield. But still, it's kind of cool to think about them that way.
And one thing that Lyle saw as well that I'm going to steal right now is that to prove their bravery, some of the nobility would also go out and hunt lions and leopards and tigers and whatever and wear the skins, very similar to what the Romans did.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Again, kind of like that status thing, like the more, exotic animal pelts you're wearing, well, the braver you are.
I've got a lion on top of a tiger on top of a leopard.
Yeah, I can't move.
It's so hot.
Well, I mean, think about that, a little bit of trivia. I mean, imagine how badass these Osaka Obachans must be to the Persians back then. I mean, all they do is wear leopard print stuff.
Nobody outside of Japan's going to get it, but yeah.
Nope.
And the next element comes from Persian society in general, or more accurately, the Achaemenid Empire, or the first Persian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea of, or thinking, arta, or truth.
Hmm.
And how druj, or lie, is very, very taboo in that culture. And they said that the Persian youths from their 5th year to their 12th year were instructed in 3 things, to ride a horse, to draw a bow, and to speak the truth. And telling a lie, apparently, was punishable by death.
That's pretty extreme, huh?
Yeah, it is.
I suppose, like telling the truth, of course, is generally a good thing. But, there's times when lying is okay. Man, death for lying is, wow.
Well, I mean, I guess you've opened up, maybe a possible loophole here where what constituted lying? Mm-hmm. Like, could you bend the truth and not be killed? But,
yeah, I mean, or were there situations where it might have been excusable to lie or something like
right,
that?
Right, right.
But I don't know, when I read this, I thought it was kind of raw meat for role-playing. And how much fun would it be to be in a PC group to have that kind of restriction on it where you're not allowed to lie?
Oh, that would last about 5 minutes in a group.
Well, exactly, but I mean, then that's the thing, is there's a very heavy penalty to it. And it's not that you're going to make your character not lie, it's kind of that you have to be careful about when and how and where you tell those lies.
Hmm. Yeah, no, it is meat for role-playing, and yeah, that would be kind of cool to set up, okay, this society, this group, lying is an offense punishable by death.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds to me a bit like you're all playing paladins, where, you kind of have this, maybe not, strict moral code, but it's paladin-esque, and that attracts only kind of a certain type of players, and if you're me, well, things just go right out the window real quick. So, it could be, I don't know, like antagonistic? Especially from the GM thing, because, even if the character lies, or if the player lies when they're in character, how are NPCs going to find out? I mean, there are ways, but then it kind of seems like the GM is just out to get you.
Yeah, isn't it like a bluff check, or, like, for example? Or subterfuge?
If this NPC is an earshot to see if they actually can hear?
Sure. I mean, like, if you go on with like bluff check or whatever, yeah, then there would be mechanical ways to find out. I was just thinking that if everybody is kind of, maybe there's the rub, like if in the society or if in this group lying is an offense punishable by death, then it stands to reason that people would assume you're telling the truth because, hey, no one wants to die, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you kind of get into a catch-22 of, yeah, they could, an NPC could tell by a bluff check if you're lying. But wouldn't they most of the time, almost always, assume that you're telling the truth?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we have laws. It doesn't mean we automatically assume that somebody killed themselves because murder is illegal.
Very good point.
I mean, if you're playing within the society and where everybody or falls under this moral code where lying is that taboo, yeah, that'd be interesting. But I think certain things would develop within that society where people would become very good at half-truths.
Mm-hmm.
People would be very good at not disclosing the truth.
Right, right.
Speaking in riddles or things like that. We had a game where we had a demon that couldn't lie.
Mm, that's true, yeah.
So but that was more of a case where you had his culture where they were forbidden from lying, and your culture where you guys just like lied every other sentence.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So you did doubt that he was telling the truth because you're like, well, that's so alien to us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's certainly one way to go. Maybe it's a bit cynical where the culture where lying is an offense punishable by death, everyone kind of gets really good at twisting the truth so that they're not lying.
I imagine some kind of like special wink would evolve to let people know.
Right. So, I totally didn't steal that pomegranate. Wink, you know. Yeah. But maybe that's I think that's kind of a cynical way to go. I guess the other extreme is just, everybody tells the truth. Pretty much all the time. And that would be a very alien culture to, explore in the game as well. Where it's like, nope, you just don't lie.
But
what carries this penalty.
Yeah. And you can take this element and just plop it into like one individual. So divorce it from the other elements. So we're not looking at one in a group of 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
But an individual happens to come from a culture like this. And everyone knows that this person can't lie.
I think it would be pretty interesting if player characters explored a society where no one could lie, or they preferred not to.
Mm-hmm.
That would just be, I think, cool to walk around and explore. I mean, obviously other stuff would have to be happening too.
So what's your PIN number?
Yeah, no, it's kind of like Lyle's example of the demon in that 13th Age game we played. Like, we assumed he was lying.
Mm-hmm.
Or we didn't realize he could only speak the truth. And
yeah, I think it was more that we doubted that he was bound to speak only the truth.
Right, so that's something that I imagine would happen if the player characters ran up to this or ran into this culture, you know?
You could have like special agents who do undercover work, like 007s. They have a license to lie. They call them the Druges or something.
That's interesting. I mean, we do give people licenses to kill as well, which is generally taboo in society.
Theoretically worse than lying.
Right.
Yeah.
I was thinking license to lie is kind of a bit lamer than license to kill.
Isn't it though?
Oh, but you can even extend that. I didn't think of this, but if you extend like all the taboos that this person is able to break in society and just the idea,
Yep, you are exempt from them.
I suppose it can kind of get into like the selling out indulgences kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's no lie.
Yeah! I can hear you putting on the glasses there. Yeah.
If everybody was from the same culture, where they couldn't lie, and they had developed those things of like half truths and twisting words and stuff, that could be interesting. People could have fun with that. But I think it's one of those things where it is alien, and I think people wouldn't understand how strange it would be until they started playing it. It's like playing, we bring it up frequently, but playing Eclipse Phase, where we don't realize how alien and strange it's going to be to play the next stage of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Until you actually do it, and you're like, hold on, how is this really going to affect how I think and how my character thinks and feels? And just something like, we lie all the time, you know? Somebody says, how do I look? And you say, oh, that's great. Yeah, you look great. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. That was good.
Well, I mean, we looked at the one side of that where, people shouldn't lie. It's punishable by death. But, like, knowing that, if you're part of that culture, I tend to think you would only ask questions that you actually wanted the answer to. Just building on Lyle's example of do I look good in this? It's like, well, the person is probably going to tell you the truth. So unless you actually want to hear what they're going to say, don't ask that question.
I wonder if that would lead to society with people with a more thick skin because they're used to being told the truth. Or, for that matter, if I wonder how much they would absorb that culture, where lying is an actual, like, mortal sin, and mortal in the way that you're going to be, you could be put to death for it. I mean, does that mean if you were talking to your friend and your friend told a lie, do you believe they would deserve death from that? Or is it something that's more just kind of institutionally put on the populace rather than actually accept it?
I don't know. Good question. Like, if your friend told a lie in that society, I think you would, I mean, unless you have absolute proof staring you right there in the face, I tend to think you would believe your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Because, hey, why would he lie, knowing what the punishment is, you know? And knowing that you've kind of been brought up to only speak the truth.
Yeah.
So you would just kind of assume that people do that.
Yeah. It's just lying is so natural, you know? My 2-year-old daughter, nobody taught her how to lie, but she's
pretty
good at it.
It's a 2-year-old kid.
Did you eat a chocolate?
No. It's because they haven't figured out consequences. Like, oh, you have chocolate around your face. Oh, that's what that is.
Consequence.
And that's why the First Persian Empire died out, because they killed all the children.
Exactly.
You know? It's like, bam, ah.
Perhaps that's why they said they had to learn it by 5. Because by 5 years of age, I think you could figure that out, maybe.
Yeah, maybe they have, like, the first 5 years, they have free reign. They can do whatever they want.
Oh, that's something, yeah.
Just lie like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah. Like you said, Chris, like a culture that has that, maybe develop very thick skins, because people are always telling the truth, right? But maybe the opposite could happen, where they have very thin skins because they don't ask those questions unless they actually want to know the answer. You know, and so it's like, I'm not going to ask how I look in this because they're compelled to tell me the truth. And so I don't really want to know. So
well, maybe that leads to an acceleration in development where they develop mirrors faster than other civilizations because they rely on their own opinions.
But just spin that out.
Like,
they rely
I
want to
see what
opinions.
I look like, you know, I could ask, but that person would give me their honest opinion.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Or maybe they're just really good at using distancing language. I guess you look okay.
Right. It could be said that you look quite fine in that robe. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's where the twisting the thing. But you get again, you could get into situations where the king says, "What do you think of this plan?" And then you have to. I don't know. You might develop certain rituals similar to like a samurai society where they will be reasonably willing to kill themselves.
Mm.
Before dishonoring themselves, and that would be the thing. Is it, you know, this plan is terrible,
right?
No, Majesty. But saying it, you are prepared to die.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, I can see that. Yeah, king says like, or the emperor. What do you think of this plan? Nobody says anything. It's like, all right.
Now
that's the sign to come up with something new.
Now you all
gotcha.
Die.
Well, no, I wasn't thinking that killing that, but it's like, okay, no one is going to answer because. They're compelled to tell the truth, but however, they don't want to make me angry, so...
Their diplomats could be famous for being very blunt.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could even think of situations where, you know, like on Christmas, you get a gift, and it's like, oh, that's just what I wanted. That's really great. Thank you, you know. But it's... Whether they're expected to cheer or whatever, they don't, unless they honestly feel that...
Right.
It's worth cheering for.
I keep thinking about Star Trek with the Betazoids, they're all telepathic, so everyone always knows what everyone else is thinking. So how lying is not a concept in their culture.
Hmm.
It's impossible. Something like that. I think I remember there was, maybe it was one of the books or something, but where what character, I think Deanna Troi's mother asked how she looked, and nobody wanted to tell her, but she, of course, being a telepath, already knew and said about how Betazoids have thick skin because of that.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was just using that how do I look is like an easy example. I didn't think it would become the focus.
Right, right. Well, it's kind of one of those loaded questions, you know?
Exactly. One of those you never want to be asked.
Right.
Didn't Chris have the PIN number example?
I did.
Like, somebody goes, what's your PIN number? You don't lie to them. You just
no,
go,
you just say, screw
yeah, I'm not
going
to tell you. Like, why? You don't go, oh, it's this number.
But that's right. Why the how do I look thing, because usually strangers don't ask you how do you look. It's somebody that's you have some kind of relationship with, so you don't want to hurt their feelings.
Right, right. Yeah, if you go, what's your PIN number? I'm not going to tell you. Oh, and I'm like, well, I didn't lie.
Oh, you've hurt my feelings.
Right, right.
Oh, yeah, I told them a lie, as you do when somebody asks you your PIN number.
Right.
Do they have your card? Oh, yeah, they picked it from my pocket. As you do. He needs these things. But, you know, he doesn't have my PIN number.
Lying is verboten, but theft is cool.
Right. Is that yours? No, it isn't. I took it from that man over there.
Yeah.
I see. Thank you for your honesty.
You're welcome.
Yes.
You live.
Yeah, you live for not telling a lie.
Did you kill this man? Yes, I did. I see.
Catch 22. Yeah.
No, it's not a catch 22. It's like, well, you avoided the death penalty for lying. The death penalty for murder, still in effect. Sorry. Mm.
Or maybe not. It's like, I have no more questions for this witness. I have no more questions for the defendant, Your Honor. You're free to go. they wouldn't even try. I was like, did you do it? Yes. All right. Free to go. But I guess, why not tell the truth if there's no consequences?
Right, right.
Gosh, every trial would end in the death penalty.
It would. Well, if the person was actually guilty.
Yeah.
And then, every trial would end with the death, because then the person who accused him, lying.
Well, no, there's a difference between being wrong and lying.
Well, true.
So finally, what kind of equipment did the immortals have?
Huge, awesome spears.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
I'm sorry, I was actually really impressed by their spears. I watched an episode of The Deadliest Warrior, which I usually try and avoid because they're pretty hyperbolic. But I was pretty impressed with the Persian spear. And I guess it was about 2.5 meters long, so longer than a person, with this very broad and quite long as well head on the top. So it was primarily a thrusting weapon, but it had a nice counterbalance on the end that I mentioned before, the apple-shaped thing, so that they could, because it was balanced, they could swing it around quite quickly. People were comparing it to the speed of a sword. And there was a big debate in the show, The Deadliest Warrior, about whether or not it would be an effective thrown weapon, because it was too heavy and the head made it not very aerodynamic. So they tried it and they hung up this pig carcass, and a couple of guys went up to it and they just threw the spear and it went straight through the pig carcass. So it was definitely an effective throwing weapon as well. So I was impressed that that large and heavy weapon could also be that quick, maneuverable, and good at range. So,
well, I'm not saying they didn't throw it, but doing research for this episode, it's like, yeah, they definitely did carry the spear, but they also carried a longbow.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a longbow, why would you throw your spear?
Yeah, especially since you need the spear when people get closer.
You can't use the longbow in melee combat like you can the spear.
Right. So, yeah, they carried the spear, they carried the longbow. I also read that they carried kind of a heavy dagger or like a short sword, and then a wicker shield, which was, kind of sticks woven with strips of leather, which apparently was great for stopping arrows, but didn't do much against Greek spears or swords. Yeah,
I wouldn't imagine, wicker doesn't really...
Yeah.
I wouldn't have actually imagined that it would do well against arrows either, but what do you know?
I mean, you hold it far enough away, I guess it gets stuck in there, you know?
And that's one of the things, like they said, the Mongolians, how they wore that silk shirt underneath their armor, and that stopped arrows as well, which I wouldn't have expected either, so, yeah.
That slows it down.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
didn't you mention, Wayne, that they had several different types of shield?
The thing I read said that there were at least three different styles, whether they carried them all at the same time or whether different groups of immortals carried different types of shields. They didn't say.
They transformed.
Maybe they did. One was kind of like a large rectangular wicker shield that, from what I read, could be planted in front of them and used as protection while they were firing their longbows. Another one was kind of like a figure eight kind of shield, almost like a double crescent.
Mm-hmm.
A third was just a round wicker shield.
Yeah. In particular with the figure eight or the viola style shield, they said it was very good offensively as well as defensively. Mm-hmm. And offensively in the sense that the kind of the curvature inward in the middle allowed them to use their offensive weapons, such as the spear that Chris talked about or the sword that Wayne mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was probably similar in use to the Greek shield, where it had that notch that you could set your spear into, so you could shield yourself while doing an attack at the same time.
Yeah, I don't think they used shield walls, though, like the Greeks did, because
no,
they
no.
were surprised when they encountered the phalanx.
Yes.
Right.
For the Very first true. Time.
And from what I read, they didn't really, or weren't really able to adapt to it. Well, because that's not true, but because by the end of the Persian Empire, they had their own Greek mercenary hoplites.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is Persian. They just adopted different parts of their empire and used that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when they first encountered the phalanx, I think by the report that we read, the immortals just ended up impaling themselves on the spears. They thought that the first shockwave would break the Greeks, and it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why. I mean, you're running at them. Why would you just keep running at the spears? But I guess the people behind you don't get the message and they kind of push you forward.
Yeah, I suppose when you talk about 1,000 troops at once, you know, the back ends of those guys just keep on coming.
Guys, stop.
Well, granted, they aren't running, but I mean, like, when we did Hoplites, the whole idea was, like, the guys behind you keep the guys in front from being pushed back, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, I imagine the same thing can happen when you're running. Hey, the charge, and even if, you know, the first 2-3 ranks of guys go down, you're just going to keep pushing into the enemy. So, mm-hmm. I mean, not saying that's how mortals fought, but, I mean, I guess against Greek Hoplites, it didn't really work very well. From what I read, a lot of the stuff they had didn't work that well against Greek Hoplites, but worked pretty well against the other, you know, Asiatic armies that they fought against to absorb into the Empire. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, the wicker shields were great for stopping arrows. They kind of had scale mail armor underneath their robes, but usually didn't have helmets, usually didn't have, you know, arm or leg armor, and were pretty lightly armored when compared to the Hoplites, but apparently that was enough to deal with the, you know, the armies that they were fighting up until they got to the Greeks.
Mm-hmm. And they had nice tiaras, too.
Yeah.
Now, to protect their face, I mean, you could use the idea of these tiaras or masks, which you see in movies like 300, and it gives them a faceless quality, which works well with the initial element that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the immortal quality.
I could see that. Yeah, you got 10,000 faceless people coming at you, and you know they're all kind of the same person because there aren't any distinguishing features except for the 1,000 yellow, the 1,000 red, and the 1,000 purple guys.
Oh, it could be like the stormtroopers. You put on the helmet, and you can't tell the difference.
True. That's a good point.
And then they kind of took that to the next level and said, no, even if you take off the helmet, they're all the same.
True.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm slow. It took me a second to realize you meant the clones and not the actual immortals. I'm like, what?
Yeah, I mean, that could be one way to do it is the clone army, and they keep it at 10,000 because
that
they just clone them.
That would be so sweet. Oh, what a cool idea if you did that in a sci-fi setting.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, there's your sci-fi setting. 10,000. Yeah, 10,000 clones.
Actually, even put it in fantasy, you know, have something where the soul returns to some source and the warrior regenerates, and that's why this nation has an inexhaustible army. Not really thinking as PCs, more as NPCs now, but still, that's cool.
Yeah, if that's the case, if they were NPCs, it's like, why haven't these guys just absolutely taken over everything by now?
They are, and that's why the PCs have to fight.
Ah, because they're stopped by the number of 10,000.
Ah, yeah, that's their limit.
Yeah, for some reason. I don't know, would it be fun to play clones?
Yes, totally. We've talked before on several occasions about how playing the same character can be fun because you search out the differences between you guys.
Yeah, but we've never talked about playing clones, which would be, like, beyond the same. You're playing identical.
Mm.
Right.
Well, they did a lot. I watched the Clone Wars TV show that they made, the miniseries, and they, a lot of the main characters were clones. And, well, but they started out as clones, very similar, but as they progressed along, like, they chose their own names and they developed different personalities. So,
sounds like
the
Unsullied
really copies, but
yeah, I was thinking the Unsullied too from Game of Thrones as well.
Yeah,
because in that one they don't even have names; they pick the Unsullied just pick their name from, you know, a random lot every day, and they were that name for that day. So,
yeah, obviously dynamic characters are more interesting, so you wouldn't want to play a clone that just stays a clone the whole time, but absolutely playing someone who starts the same as every other character but develops on their own path, that could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was thinking it might be a bit, depends on what you focus on, I think. It could be a bit much if you try and do, like, the army conquest as well as, you know, developing the character.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, if you did something where, yeah, you're all clones, you're all exactly the same, except when you start to differentiate, you know.
Or I could use the idea of the tier and the mask is that if you go back to the smaller scale Council of Eight, they don't know their identities.
Right.
Because they all wear masks or tiaras to hide it.
That would especially work in that kind of political theater as well, so you don't know whose voice and whose alliance it is.
Right. That sounds like a group of bad guys where it's like, you know.
Doesn't it, though?
Yeah. Okay, everybody put on the mask, and yeah, there you go.
Well, the Venture Brothers had that.
Yeah.
Where they're all behind the screen, but they...
Yeah, there's that funny bit where it's like, well, that's obviously such and such, because look at the shape of his head. We all know who that is, you know? It's just these silhouettes on the screen. And it's like, oh, don't pretend we don't know who you are.
Yeah.
And another Warriors episode ends up on the Venture Brothers.
Right.
With the weapons, I think they're one of the more balanced or diverse warriors that we've covered. Because a lot of times, we've done like the Mongols, where they specialize in the bow. We actually did the longbowmen specializing in the longbow. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But here they have long range and short range and, well, mid range as well. So all of those covered.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the warriors that we focus on are famous because they're very specialized and thus extremely skilled in one area and therefore cool. But, we don't focus on multi-skilled ones so much. So, yeah.
In this case, they were just kind of special because they were, well, set apart in the army, kind of within the army.
And immortal.
Yeah, and all the kind of special treatment they got. But, yeah, they kind of filled a lot of different roles on the battlefield, I imagine, with their versatility.
Yeah, they're elite soldiers, but still not specialized soldiers.
Right.
All right, well, that ends our episode on the Persian immortals. So as you can see, they're a little bit different than as they were depicted in 300.
Right.
Yeah, so they weren't orc ninjas.
Yeah. Don't know why that's so funny.
And we pulled out a few elements that we think are pretty interesting about the Persian immortals. There is the idea of Anusha, which is the idea of them being immortals, or the less cool companions.
Mm-hmm.
There is the idea of Istina, which is they're special or they're separate but not equal from the rest of the army. And there's the idea of Arta, truth. And they must follow the truth because Druj, the lie, is forbidden.
Punishable by death.
Yes.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idledredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time. Bye.
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 Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.